Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, an unauthorized podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the Thomas Harris Hannibal books. I'm Cooper, and I have with me...
Hey, it's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And tonight we are talking about episode 6 of season 1, Entree. And we are drinking a private label port, chocolate raspberry port. Private label from the Beckett Vineyards.
It's delicious.
Yes.
So, sorry, this one you can't get. But go out and find yourself a good folladeur. So let's talk about the Chesapeake Ripper. That was first mentioned last episode.
Yes.
And did you know, Miko, before this episode, that Hannibal Lecter is the Chesapeake Ripper?
No, I didn't. Because I'm only like 60% through Red Dragon right now.
Yeah.
So I did not know that.
Well, when this came up the first time, I remembered that that was Hannibal Lecter. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if they were going a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because they introduced Dr. Abel Gideon, played by the Eddie Izzard, yes.
Yeah, I think I didn't know when it was first mentioned, because I hadn't gotten that far.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time we watched the other episode, I was starting to make, like, that...
Well, I like that they seeded it last episode.
Yeah.
But they seeded it in such a ham-fisted way, because it's like, well, the organs weren't removed, so it's not the Ripper.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, good.
Okay.
Good, because we were worried
about that it might be the
Ripper.
Like we were all sitting there going, could it be? But they kind of do that. They, you know, they pull little bits and pieces out and don't necessarily give it to us full out. They hide it in dialogue.
Right.
And you'll get a little thing and you'll just go, oh, that's from this book or that's from this moment.
Right? And they've been doing this in little sprinkles. This episode is full of... Silence of the Lambs.
Very much
full of
so. Oh, yeah.
And
it is rampant.
It is the only episode written by staff writer Kai Yu Wu.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's for the best.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this episode felt a little ham-handed to me. There's a lot to like here.
Yeah.
And the Chesapeake Ripper stuff and... Dr. Gideon's stuff. I think let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that really stuck out immediately for me is I used to collect screenplays when the internet was born and you could find anything there. So I'd go on and collect screenplays. And when I got the Silence of Lambs screenplay, it had this little blurb at the beginning that said, due to rights issues, we are uncertain of the naming rights for Dr. Hannibal Lecter, for the sake of this screenplay, Hannibal Lecter will instead be named Gideon Quinn.
Ah.
And so when Dr. Abel Gideon showed up, I thought that was
sense.
Just a really cool little tie back to that.
Because he is definitely the Silence of the Lambs Lecter is what he's...
And I think that's the show trying to distance itself from Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the fact that at this point in the show, still... 2 seasons in, they may not be able to do Silence of the Lambs because they don't have the rights to Clarice Starling or James Gum, so they can't do those.
They can't
things.
Do those.
But this episode really felt like Brian Fuller almost pointing out to MGM, which owns the rights, maybe I'll just do it without you.
Right.
I've got Miriam Less, who's sort of Clarice Starling.
Yes.
I've got another Hannibal Lecter. Look, I'll have 2 Hannibal Lecters in this show if you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put him in the exact same cell from Silence of Lambs, and we'll see how you like it.
It was, it was definitely Silence of Lambs all over it.
Yeah.
But it was just enough to not be specifically,
right.
But having that flavor.
And it was that great thing where, you know, we've heard this story in both Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs about when Hannibal ate the nurse's tongue, when he pretended to have a heart issue, and his pulse never got above 80, I believe.
I thought it was 70, but 70 something.
Somewhere around
there. Yeah, I don't remember.
It stayed low.
It stayed low.
Yes.
And so we immediately open this episode getting to see, essentially, a simulacrum Hannibal doing this thing that we've heard about.
Exactly. Pretending to be, you know, unconscious, you know, rushing.
Slowing his heart rate
exactly.
down.
Rushing him to the infirmary. And what do? They leave him
they
alone.
They leave the nurse alone.
With the,
yeah.
With
and
the nurse.
I made a note. Nurse left alone in a dark room with Gideon?
Yeah.
Question mark? And then the show is smart enough, even with a less than adequate writer, to later say, from Will, you left her alone with Abel Gideon? And, yeah, because Abel Gideon had been a model prisoner up until then.
Mm.
You know, so
yeah,
that's
so
why.
Yeah, so they didn't think.
Just like Hannibal Lecter.
Just like Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
But, you know, but no one ever trusted Hannibal.
That's true.
The entire time, like, he had to essentially be dying for them to risk it with him. But what this also brought up for me was something I've always wondered about Hannibal. Is how can he not have a beard? Who goes in with a razor and gets near Hannibal Lecter's face? I'm not talking about Mads Mikkelsen Hannibal. I'm talking about Anthony Hopkins Hannibal. I'm talking about Brian Cox Hannibal.
Yeah.
Why on earth do they not just let him grow his beard long?
Right, because then they would either have to give him a blade to shave.
All by himself.
All by himself.
Or
someone
they
would
have to take the giant restraint mask off of him
And
shave him. And this Hannibal Lecter, Abel Gideon, has a well-trimmed goatee.
Yes.
So that means somebody is shaving his face.
Yes.
The poor barber that goes in and does this.
Or he's allowed, you know...
Well, he was a model prisoner.
Yeah, trimming equipment. Exactly. Yeah. You know. If he has been a model prisoner, he might have been, you know, able to have some of that stuff in his room. Just like he was allowed to write to people, and he was allowed to have books. And,
but he only used felt pens.
Mm-hmm.
And the books couldn't have staples.
It's true.
It just, it felt like they were, it's one of those things that's always bugged me in the series, actually.
But it was funny, the whole time he was lying on the gurney, instead of watching her,
I was watching
his hands.
Yeah.
Because I knew he was going to figure out a way to get out. And even in that scene, you could see him working on the lock. And I was like, and so I knew it was going to happen. It was just a matter of when. At any moment. There was a lot of tension in that moment. And man, talk about gruesome.
The eye gouging.
Oh my God. Yeah. Mm. And there are times in the show I'm really amazed that I'm watching network television.
Yeah. That was
because
one of them.
Granted, the blood was very dark. I mean, you know, I know we've talked before about the darkness
shade of
the
red that they're allowed to use.
This was nearly black.
Well, it's that they get away with it because they're shooting with blue light.
Mm.
So blue light makes red blood look black.
Mm, I see. Because it definitely was really, but when he put his fingers on her eyes, I thought they're going to cut away. They're going to cut away. They're going to, no, they're not cutting away. Oh,
why
my God.
Why aren't they cutting away?
Oh, I wish they cut away. I have to cover my eyes. Yeah, things like, because I'm not a squirmish person. I love horror movies, and I've watched some pretty graphic things. But I don't know. There's just something about
the scenes that will be burned into your
retina.
Yeah. I don't know. Anything like that. Just, it is. It's just, it's really gruesome. And then you see the aftermath of all that. And they just show everything, her empty eyes and all that stuff stuck in her. They've been very bold. You know, you've had the flayed backs, the exposed ribs. You see, basically, when he's done, she's stuck with, a ton of things in the room.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so this gives us our first glimpse of Wound Man, which... I think we can say, because we've seen the events of Wound Man unfold in this episode, that that is what gets Hannibal caught in the novels.
Yeah.
Is basically what we see Miriam Last do. She's in Hannibal's office because she's consulting and asking him about patients. She notices a drawing on there, and it is the Wound Man. And she remembers, hey, Wound Man looks exactly like this Chesapeake Ripper victim.
Mm-hmm.
And while she's putting it together, Hannibal comes up behind her.
Mm.
In the book, Hannibal comes up behind Will and guts him with a linoleum knife.
Right. Because Will is the one that finds it. He goes to the office. While he's talking to him, he sees it up on the bookshelf.
And lest you cry, spoiler, dear listener, Will survives that encounter.
Yeah.
Because it takes place pre-Red Dragon.
Yes.
And the fact that we've seen it now,
right,
essentially, with Miriam Lass, means we're probably not getting that.
Right. I know. That's what I thought was really interesting, is that they gave that reveal to her. And it was originally Will's thing.
And I feel like what this episode really does, and I wonder if this is Brian Fuller's intention, is say to the network, say to the viewers, this is not what you think it is.
Right.
Yeah, we are going to do things differently in this show than you expect. The things that you do expect, we're probably going to show them to you in ways you didn't expect them. And so we're seeing that now with that moment with Miriam Lass.
Right, you take something that's familiar and then assign it to somebody else or do it differently. And it was this one in particular, I felt like I saw so many elements from Red Dragon, but not in any way exactly the way they're depicted in the novel.
I would say almost half the dialogue in this episode is lifted either from Red Dragon or Silence.
Yes.
And I think it's fascinating that it might be lifted from Silence because they really don't have the rights to that.
Ah.
Yeah.
So I wonder how they're able to do that. Or maybe it is character rights. I don't know.
Mm.
But there are lines in this, and a lot of what Dr. Chilton says is like the not FBI either. You have a temporary ID.
You have a temporary ID. That's
a reference. Yes. I think that's Hannibal saying that to Clarice in Silence, is that you have a temporary ID.
Oh,
I don't think it's,
I haven't seen
it's Chilton.
Yeah, it says trainee.
Yeah.
Trainee.
I love all these little bits. So you gave me a lot of shit last week, Ophelia, for loving the character of Frederick Chilton.
I did.
Did you remember how awesome Chilton's character is?
I remember how awesome the actor who depicts him.
And it's Raul Esparza.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The way he plays Chilton is spot on. But I have to say that he is still one of the skin-crawling, creeper-type, just snake in the grass.
Definitely snake in the grass.
Type character.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, everything about him is opportunistic. It's all about him being, you know, well-known. And the way he's dressed impeccably.
He wants to be the one.
He is everything about, I guess, psychiatry or psychology that you hate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and having, you know, dealt with this world, there is a point where you're like, I understand that you are doing something that you had to go to school for, just like a medical doctor, you have to know. But there are people out there that it doesn't seem like they're doing it for that particular reason to be helpful. It's a lot of freaking money.
Well, they're doing it to further themselves.
Themselves,
that's what it is
exactly.
About.
And specifically, you know, Chilton with his, how he's like proud of being able to, you know, I've caught the Chesapeake. I was looking for him. The only reason why I couldn't find him is because I already had him. What a douchebag.
Well, to me, that says, okay, how did you not know you already had
him? Yeah.
If you're that good.
Exactly.
Well, I want to talk about that scene with Chilton and Jack and Will.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an interesting scene because Will is so visibly uncomfortable.
Yes.
It's like everything he was afraid of happening in the pilot when he was assigned to Hannibal Lecter, because he just felt like, okay, somebody is going to try to crawl inside my head.
Right.
And Chilton doesn't even disguise it.
No.
It's like, hey, you want to come talk to my staff?
Oh,
you know, not today, of course.
But treats him like he's an experiment.
Yeah.
Like,
right away.
He has not assigned any humanity to Will whatsoever. Because he talks, he says, your sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it, everything about the way he talks about it, it's like, oh no, we're fascinated with this thing, you know, with the way you do, and like he's a science experiment or he's not human, you know.
What it reminds me of is the old school sanitarium
doctors
who would indeed experiment and call it treatments. He gives me that kind of vibe, and I think too, it's my experience of having seen doctors for psychiatry, that I have met individuals in this field who are so much more interested in just the making money part of it and to pushing the medications and not necessarily being good rehabilitative doctors, because that's, you are a doctor. And he gives me that creepy vibe of like the old school sanitarium where he would just as soon drill a hole in your brain
exactly.
to put a little plastic window so he could see how it works.
Like, because he knows it'll get him in all the journals.
Exactly, because it's a revolutionary new treatment.
Exactly.
And he, without it actually being beneficial to the individual or the patient. And I think it really shows the way you were saying that he was out for the fame and also in the way he was had this instant latch on curiosity to Will, your particular condition. And it just, it wasn't even like he was talking to Will as an individual or even as somebody who was there to help the FBI, but like a bug in a jar.
Yes, exactly.
Well, and it speaks right away to Will's fear that he tells Jack on the way in to the Baltimore Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
I wrote it down because I don't know why. It just seemed like an interesting
Well, I abbreviated title. It with BHCS, but then I couldn't remember what it stood for.
I had the BH for in Criminally Insane.
The BH. We're down with the BH.
We're down with the BH.
But Will says that he's afraid, he doesn't like going to these places because he's afraid they won't let him back out. And right away, Chilton is saying, hey, maybe you can come back here and we'll talk. And you know, part of Will is thinking, man, if I come back here without Jack Crawford,
I'm never
they
leaving.
Won't let me out.
Yeah. Well, Jack will be stuck also here. Assures him that he's not going to be left, at least not today.
Not today. And so they go in, and we get, after the credits, we're rushed directly into one of Will's reenactments.
Yes.
And I like the way they've been doing this, where it's really, we lose the pendulum at the beginning, but it immediately throws us off, because again, we see Will doing these things, and these things are pretty horrible. Like, we don't see Abel Gideon shove his thumbs into this nurse's eye. We see Will
doing it.
We see Will weigh the what is that? It's an IV stand he picks up.
He weighs one
and it's like, yeah, this might be good, and then he stabs her with it. So it's again this horrible thing that we see our hero
because at the beginning we only get a tease of it. You know, it's like he comes and he gets her. He gets the girl, and then we see, you know, the body. We see all of the graphic stuff happen with Will.
And when Will comes out of it, he's even more unhinged than usual. So we're really starting to feel the effects. You know, we talked about this in the last episode, but this episode starts to show us the detrimental effects of coming out of this.
There's definitely a lot of transformation going on here. Even, I noticed very early on before this that Will is no longer in his standard sepia tone hues. He's wearing a blue shirt.
He is. I noticed that this episode. There's a lot of blue.
Yes, there's a lot of blue in this episode.
The entire, you know, the lower level dungeon where they keep Abel Gideon, the almost exact same dungeon as in Silence of the Lambs.
It looks almost
like
exactly.
The set design clearly took, okay, here's what I want. Build it.
They did some really wonderful moments because he would talk when Alana was in there, and he kind of stalked it, and there were bars, and there were times where he said certain things, and he would cross perfectly timed to where one of the bars would then put his face in shadow.
Yeah, Eddie Izzard played. And there is nothing more impressive in this episode than Eddie Izzard's performance. He nails the performance of creepy Anthony Hopkins Hannibal Lecter, because that is what he is.
Exactly. Super polite, super probing, uncomfortable, yeah. And you can't even tell why it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because he just looks like a normal dude. But the way he's looking at you, the his choice of words.
The way he leans against the bar.
Yes.
Especially when he's flirting with Alana.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this flashback.
We go back 2 years.
We have a few flashbacks in this episode. Mm-hmm. And right away, I mean, you know, we watch enough television to see the tropes mm-hmm. here. And the low saturation bad beard flashback.
Yes.
Really, that is the tropiest trope that ever troped.
It almost looked like it was parallel universe, yeah. Jack.
I mean, Lawrence Fishburne, I've seen him with a beard. Mm-hmm. He looks good with a beard.
This was
and
awful.
A closely yeah. cropped beard like that, he couldn't have grown that over the course of a week. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have actually had him grow one. But that beard is hideous yeah. on him.
And you don't have, I mean...
Just because it was two years ago doesn't mean you had
a, yeah. Yeah, he could have been... There are people who are clean-shaven their entire lives.
Yes.
You know? They're just,
I'm surprised they didn't give him, like, long hair.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Because that's usually what we do. We either give him hair, give him a beard.
Yeah. You know what? Putting that little bit of, you know, wording that says... 2 years ago,
it does just fine.
Is
yeah.
all we need. Yeah. It's all we need. They can look exactly the same. They don't
or
need.
Or go ahead and do black and white. That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cheating. We yeah. know it's cheating. It's cheating. Mm-hmm. But go ahead.
But
it's
you don't
okay.
have to give them a bad.
The bad
goatee.
Beard is
that
too
was,
much.
That was yeah, not necessary.
And our starling proxy, Miriam Lass, nice. Played by my girls, Anna Chlumsky.
Mm.
It was nice to see her again.
Mm-hmm.
She had a weird accent.
They really go into a lot into her background, which I thought was mm-hmm. really interesting. Everything from how she was... I guess there is a connection to Will there.
Well, they're sprinkling in, okay, Jack has lost someone before.
Right.
You know, because that was a question. Have you ever lost someone in the field before? And he has.
Yes.
And he even looks off. To imagine this flashback.
Right, yeah.
And he is looking off when we come back from the flashback. So, I mean, they were moments away from dilly-doo, dilly-doo, yeah. dilly-doo, dilly-doo. I mean, really, it's so hoary. Yeah. I feel like the show is better than this.
Right. They used a lot of very simple conventions.
And I think, you know, recalling this episode mm-hmm. is I recalled this as, hey, this is the one where they introduce Eddie Izzard and do all the Silence of the Lambs stuff. And it's pretty cool. And it is pretty cool.
Oh, and it is. It's like...
But a lot of the... I noticed the dialogue is very on the nose and very expository. It's like they have characters essentially explaining the stuff that we need to know in order to follow the episode. Yeah. Which is not the way they normally do
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And maybe that's why there seemed to be so much in it from the books.
Yeah.
Because they were mm-hmm. setting things up, everything down to how he explains how Dr. Gideon gets more mail than
yes.
anyone else. And that's Hannibal.
Well, it's funny how much of Hannibal they gave to this character.
Yeah, they gave him a lot.
And it does make me wonder, you know, a lot of this show makes me wonder if Brian Fuller's trying to cram as much as possible into it because he doesn't feel he's going to get much more.
Oh.
You know, like some of the announcements about season
now.
3 really feel like, okay, if I'm not getting a season 4, I'm going to give you absolutely
everything
I've ever conceived of for this show.
And then if I get season 4, I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there is so much in here. Everything. I think they even bring up about how he's writing to other journals.
Yes, he writes to journals, but he won't talk about himself.
But he won't, yeah.
Yeah.
And,
which
and
is
the put a blood pressure cuff on my penis.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
to see what I like, yeah, while doing a Rorschach test, yeah. I mean, all of it is that. Yeah, I'm surprised we didn't have the. He gave him a recipe for dip.
Yes,
you know? He was a very antagonistic character mm-hmm. in this.
There was a really nice sequence where both Alana and Will are going to talk to Gideon, and it's intercut back and forth between the two of them, so we don't have to see Alana talk to him, and then we'll talk to him. We get to see him talking to both of them, and the way he plays them differently, but we also see that he's playing them the same, which I thought was a really nice effect.
And it was nice, too, because when they actually sort of had a powwow about how they were going to do that beforehand, you know, that they weren't going to go in together, they were going to go in separately, and how they were going to... So you got to see their plan sort of unfold, where Alana had her course, and Will had his, and how they stuck to it, and what they were going... How they were going to deal with him, that Alana was kind of just going to come in... And make and not antagonize him, but kind of keep. Whereas Will was very blunt and really didn't go with the way Gideon wanted to push him.
No, he didn't.
Yeah,
and I think that's interesting because it shows Gideon didn't quite understand Will. And there was that one line that Gideon had where. They talk about what the effect you were hoping to accomplish with this nurse. And he says, the effect I was hoping to accomplish was her death.
Yes.
Mission accomplished.
Yes.
I thought that was a nice little... And he did it with this Eddie Izzard-type flourish.
Yeah.
The little quick...
Mission accomplished. Yeah.
But what I really like about the first act is Gideon says he doesn't have to convince them. And... Will points out, well, it's what somebody needs is to convince that, you know, that you're in prison. And we fill in the blank in our head while we cut to commercial.
Yes.
And then we come back at Hannibal's.
At Hannibal's. With Jack,
yeah. And this was another one of those scenes where it just felt half-baked and overwritten, where Jack's all bitchy that Hannibal won't tell him about Bella.
Right.
And he can't talk to her because she won't talk to him. Can't stop thinking. I mean, it's... And this is it. You can't save her. Who else couldn't you save? And then Jack
and
looks
then,
off.
Yeah,
and
looks off. That's
I mean,
true.
Come on.
Aimless.
This show is so much better than this kind of writing.
Yeah, we go back to... exactly. It's like, because he's talking about how he can't, like you were saying, he can't stop thinking about when she's going to die. And then
she's going to die. I thought that was nice. Where would she die? Will she die in the bed? I thought that was a nice touch. But it just, it felt like, okay, we have to have a scene here.
Right.
And you know what we haven't talked about yet this episode is Bella.
Right.
So here he's going to go and bitch about Bella. Will feeling like this is plagiarism, I thought was a really interesting little touch to kind of hang a lantern on the fact that this is essentially like plagiarizing the Hannibal Lecter story at this point.
Very
much. I thought that was a really cool thing, and I wonder if it was an intentional thing because we are seeing an episode about a fake version of Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
In an episode about a fake version of Hannibal Lecter. And on one hand, I think Brian Fuller is clever and interested enough to do that.
Right.
But with the otherwise poor quality of the writing on this episode, I mean, I suppose that's more concept than actual writing.
Yes.
So I doubt that Caillou Wu was like, okay, here's what I'm going to do for my episode.
Right.
I'm sure it was, okay, these are the points. These are the
Yeah, exactly. There's already a path.
Yeah.
You know, that he's set. So I'm sure that when you go in and write an episode, it's like, okay, this is where this has to
lead.
We'll
break it together.
Yeah.
And
exhibiting
really,
any consistency.
This really feels inconsistent to the rest of them. And I'm glad it wasn't just me, because it does feel like a weaker version of everything else. And the references don't feel clever.
Right.
You know, we're using all this dialogue from Red Dragon. Like, everything Chilton says is almost directly from the books.
Yeah.
But it's not clever.
I think beforehand it was put in a way that was very profound or poetic.
Yeah.
And now it just seems like it's replacing dialogue.
Like, okay, we can use this.
I can't come up with better dialogue, so let's use what's in the book. and lifting out whole things. Like, Chilton is almost exactly from the book. And basically, if you just superimpose Gideon over, you know, book Hannibal, a lot of that is almost...
And you have it.
Yeah, it's almost like a lazy way of writing it. Rather than finding something interesting, like taking an intro remark from the book and making it into a beautiful moment for Will, or, you know, taking someone else's line of dialogue, or not even a line of dialogue, I've seen...
But the descriptions.
Descriptions
in the book,
in the book converted into lines of dialogue that are beautiful. That didn't happen as much here. Like, I didn't write as many scenes, as much, like, quotable moments in this. There are, like, little bits and pieces, like how, you know, he tells Jack, you have a peculiar cleverness. There's little things like that that I liked, but I didn't find the dialogue as beautiful and poetic as it has in the
And
in the
I noticed that, too, is mm-hmm. I made a few notes, but I wasn't as careful with the actual dialogue.
Yeah, neither was I, which is unusual because I've been so loving it.
There was one scene, and we will get to it. I want to hold off a little bit. But it was, again, a Hannibal dinner scene that really felt Brian Fuller.
Ah, you know, maybe he had come in and cleaned up that one.
One of the funny things about when you feel that really like the... There's two types of dialogue in the show that feel like, okay, this is what the show is. And one of them is the weird poetic, nobody's actually speaking in literalisms. It's all metaphorical. It's like the Will Hannibal dialogues.
Yeah.
You know, when it's just back and forth, I'm going to throw something out that maybe doesn't directly connect to what you said to me. And then there's the, let's see how many jokes we can cram into Hannibal's dialogue. Yeah. And that, because it's something that's so direct from the first episode, I feel like that is Brian Fuller at his most giddy as an author here. He is loving Hannibal, knowing he's smart enough to get away with the fact that he is so obviously a cannibal.
Yeah. Where he basically is coming right out and saying it. But
so let's talk about the MacGuffin in this episode. Because we think it's the Chesapeake Ripper.
Yeah.
But no, it's these phone calls from a dead girl. From our flashback girl, Miriam Lass.
Yes.
That, again, is this hoary thing that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, and
it's like it becomes one of those cliche like horror movie or horror where it's like they're going to do the thing for you, or the you know, it's he's there and he wakes up and it's like every horror movie, you know, the babysitter's alone in the house, he's calling from the house, you know, kind of moment. It's the voice of this dead girl. Is she still alive?
You know, the other trope, it's like, that's really interesting because that is such a horror movie cliche.
Yeah.
The other horror movie cliche that they way overuse here is everybody doubting Jack.
Yes.
It's like, okay, yeah, his wife is dying. I get it.
Yes.
But he's not the kind of guy that tells you something like this.
No.
But everybody is questioning him on it. And they're questioning every bit of it. And it's just like, okay, why are we doing this? Why we know he heard that.
Yes.
Because unlike Will, where we jump in and out of reality.
Right. Jack is firmly footed in reality. Yeah, in reality. And I thought it was rather interesting, too, because they were very vague about whether or not Miriam was killed.
Right. Jack is very confident.
Jack knows, but as from what they're showing us, they give us this whole very complicated storyline.
Well, and
about
we don't
her.
See the kill
right.
until the end.
Until the end. So, but when they make this phone call, the viewer hasn't been given all the information yet. So when you hear her voice, the viewer doesn't know whether or not that is. Because the only hint he gives is when they talk about the last killer, the last murder.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, the last victim of the Chesapeake Ripper had this. And all Jack says is the last one found, because the last... The last victim was never found.
Right.
He never says it's Miriam Lass. We don't find that out till afterwards.
Yeah.
So when this phone call comes in, it's very much manipulating us in a cliche way, where it's like, is she alive? you know, what's going on?
Do we care?
Do we care? Yeah.
Should we care?
Isn't until later on when people are like, she can't have called. Because the whole time that was happening, I'm like, why is everyone giving him a hard time about this phone call?
Yeah.
Until then they start revealing.
Why are they fighting with him about whether she's alive or not?
Yeah.
If they doubt she made the call, why are they doubting that she's dead?
Yeah.
Jack is saying she's dead, but she made the call. They're saying she probably didn't make the call, but she's probably alive. What the hell is that conflict?
Yeah, there was a lot of, you know. And then the fact that here they are, you know, seasoned investigators, and no one could think that her voice is recorded.
Yeah, nobody comes up with that.
Yeah. And what I thought was interesting that her voice was recorded because Will listens to Mrs. Leeds' answering machine message.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And that whole thing of the voice of the dead coming back. Because I know there was like, I remember it happened in there, so I thought it was interesting that they would use...
And then not comment on it.
Yeah.
We get to see the Raven Stag again in the worst CGI in the show. And when it walks into the classroom, that is bad CGI. It's a cool moment.
Yeah.
And it would have been good if the CGI had been at all good.
It gave a tinge of Will's haziness. Because it wasn't clear.
If he was asleep or awake.
It wasn't sure that he was kind of between the, you know, the sleep and his consciousness. Mm-hmm. And his eyes were all wide open and it looked as though he was reading.
Yeah, and he was in a place that's realistic that he normally is.
Yeah,
right. During the middle of the day, and then it was kind of, you know, that suspended area where you're dozing and kind of hallucinating at the same time, and then it was that blurry transition into it being.
Well, then he's woken up by Jack and Alana, which is interesting because, you know, we were talking about how the Raven Stag is people in Will's life. In the hospital, the Raven Stag is the sound of Alana's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last episode, the Raven Stag is Winston nudging at his, nuzzling at his arm. And in this one, it's Jack and Alana. Mm-hmm. So every time the Raven Stag is represented by a sound in reality when Will is seeing it, or a sound in reality when Will is dreaming, it has been someone who's on Will's side. Someone who's the good guy.
The good guy.
Essentially. And here they have that conversation about pushing the Ripper. Which again,
direct from the book.
Yes. And they wanted
and getting Freddie to write something.
Yeah.
Inflammatory, because they figured he is.
Inflammatory.
Ah, yes, I didn't even realize I did that. I'm sorry, that was completely accidental.
All the readers of Red Dragon, those who have seen Manhunter and those who have seen the movie Red Dragon just got a little laugh about it.
Yes, they did. That was completely unintentional.
But Jack's making the point to push him to kill, and Will seems taken aback at this, that he's actually willing to enrage him to kill again just in order to bring him out. And I think it could be that Jack can't stop thinking about the loss of Bella, that he's kind of more on edge and he's more focused on the ends justifying the means.
He's not making rational decisions.
And this ghost from his past is calling him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's so, I mean, all the most stress literal, of that, too.
The ghosts of the past are haunting him by getting phone calls
from a ghost of somebody's death he could not prevent.
Yeah.
Just like what he's going through now.
And I feel like this episode also kind of shows us how we have this very interesting dynamic going on where we have Will losing control, Jack losing control, Alana not really sure if she should be going on, but this kind of morbid curiosity that she has, and of course, Hannibal being the puppet master, trying to just see what will happen. But we have the people who had previous to all being together and influencing each other, somewhat having control of themselves. I mean, Will, being definitely different, had control over himself as being a teacher. And then we had Jack, who was relatively in control of himself. But it's this interesting combination with this group together dynamic that you start that seeing them make these decisions that are out of character because mm-hmm. of the stress they're under, and you see the coaxing that Hannibal likes to do towards these somewhat destructive pathways for certainly for Will, mm-hmm. and it almost seems a little bit for Jack sometimes. And then I just think it's interesting to see. It's like, if these people were surrounded by more rationally thinking people,
they were surrounded by good people.
Exactly. People with more,
people who don't delight in just seeing. Okay, I mean, basically everything Hannibal's doing is a stress test.
Yes.
It's like, okay, well, what happens if I
test? Not just I suppose it would be a physical stress test, but it's an ethical stress test. Like, I wonder what you would do if I made this suggestion about some very unethical ways of, you know, manipulating.
You know, he's
people.
Playing the let's see what happens when we take away the puppy game.
Right. So, I mean, this is just a part of where you start to see little clips and pieces of Jack maybe not necessarily acting the way he would have under other circumstances, and nobody's
not being
checking
the
him.
Guru.
Yeah,
right.
Which in a huge bit of obnoxious on the nose dialogue, hey, we call you the guru.
But nobody's checking him here.
No,
and I find that interesting. But while Will is taken aback by it, he doesn't check him, and neither does Alana.
Well,
Alana
last time Will said
right
something, Jack got all pissed
all
off.
All kinds
and
of pissed off.
The entire
he got sent to the principal's office.
Ran away.
Yeah.
So who knows what that would happen if he said something again.
To me personally, I think it's more significant that Alana herself is not stepping up here and saying, you know what? Maybe we don't want to do this.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
That's true that she just goes along with it.
Right. She's like, okay, yeah, maybe we need to enrage him to kill him.
Maybe we need to get Freddie Lowndes killed. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that'd be good. Well, you know.
Maybe that's what made it an easy choice for
them. Well, it's not even just Freddie, necessarily.
Yeah, and they weren't really talking about Freddie Lowndes at this point.
They were talking about another victim.
Yeah. Can we push him? And so we get Freddie.
But they get Freddie,
That is where they're going with this.
And one of the big points of clever dialogue in here is the listing of who's most likely to be a psychopath.
Yes.
And number 5 is surgeons. Okay, so that gives us Hannibal and Dr. Gideon. Number 6 is journalists. Okay, Freddie. And number 7 is law enforcement, which is the rest of our crew.
Yes.
So, you know, and then Freddie has that great line, here we are, a bunch of psychopaths helping each other out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice.
Yes.
Did you notice Freddie keeps her gloves on indoors?
No, I didn't notice
scene,
that in this scene.
She has her gloves on, and when she goes to meet with Gideon, she's wearing her gloves. She's not wearing a coat anymore, but she is
wearing
her
gloves.
I thought that was odd.
I didn't notice
All I noticed in that particular scene is how seductive she was dressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that she hasn't been before. She's had usually something. They always kind of play a very sexy edge to her, which I don't really know why.
Well, the internet finds her incredibly sexy.
But it's the internet. She could look like anybody.
No, I'm saying the internet in the real world.
Oh, in the real world,
I don't know about the internet in the world of Hannibal. But the internet in the real world.
Hypothetical world.
The Tumblr verse.
Oh, I'm sure.
Finds
well,
her
in this one,
sexy.
She's got like a bra on and her top's kind of open mm-hmm. over. There's a lot of like very provocative.
And you know,
dress.
If Dr. Chilton had anything to say about that, he would say, I don't even believe that Dr. Gideon has seen a woman in 8 years, because, you know, that we're just cribbing lines from other stories here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where Freddie Lowndes really enters the target zone for Hannibal.
Yeah.
He's already pointed out her rudeness in the recording of the conversation between him and Will. Now we cut over to a scene of him reading her article.
Yeah, he is not happy.
This episode was directed by Michael Reimer, who has directed a few episodes here. He directed the Amuse-Bouche episode, which was the Mushrooms episode. Mm-hmm. But I felt like the angry Hannibal performance was, okay, so we're seeing Mads Mikkelsen at 0 to 1 normally on a 10-level scale of big in his performance. Let's say Freddie Lowndes is around 8.
Nah.
But Michael Mads Mikkelsen, Michael Madsen, wow.
Wouldn't
that be something?
Yeah.
Michael Madsen would be a horrible Hannibal Lecter. But Mads is usually between 0 and 1. And I think this anger sort of gets us to 3.
Yes.
And to me, that's overacting at this point.
For Hannibal, it's
for Hannibal. When Hannibal is angry at the Tattlecrime article, is that the point where the audience knows he is the Chesapeake Ripper?
In your opinion?
I know what I don't know. And I think it's only because I'm tainted with knowledge.
Yeah.
Because I already know, I don't know.
It's harder how, to see it that way.
How to see it. It's like I saw it and it was an instantaneous, oh, that's just like, yeah. And now we know what happens next when you don't piss him off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because it's that whole thing of you start to learn that there's a pride mm-hmm. that you're dealing with. And that when you start, and it's in both Hannibal and Dolaride, that whole thing of once they start getting insulted,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're really tender. And they want to be known as brilliant and beautiful. And when they start seeing the opposite being written about them, they don't have a very delicate way of dealing with it. There's ego.
He may as well have thrown the iPad across the room.
Yeah.
For the level of that performance there. Just
Right. But I guess in that
I moment, better call Jack as Miriam Lass again.
Right, exactly.
Which he does next scene.
Mm-hmm.
While Jack is interviewing Gideon. So it begs the question, is Hannibal angry enough that he's just like, no, look at me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want your attention because I'm the actual threat.
Right.
That's, you know, standing right behind you.
While Gideon's saying, don't be mad at me, again, in a lovely moment from Eddie Izzard, using his hands. He does a lot of the prayer stance in this and the wide open hands.
Mm-hmm.
And really, he is the treasure in this episode. Mm-hmm. He is the vast goodness.
What I loved about this is when he's like, he admits to killing her, but by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack asks, but you didn't put her on display. And he does that in that very lovely way that he has of saying things. Is, who says I didn't?
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of things left open here. He's basically admitting it.
Well, and we're finding Miriam's hair and fingerprints at Jack's house now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also I wanted to point out with this call, the Miriam last call that happens while he's at
The prison, The hospital, yeah.
It's from the house.
The killer is calling.
The killer is calling from the house.
The victim is calling
from inside the house. The victim is calling,
It has the addendum.
Oh, yeah, the longer version.
Of having her say, I don't want to die like this. And so, I mean, there was a sort of question of her being alive or... Was there a question of being alive or dead before
Doubt has been receded.
Yes.
Because before everybody is convinced of their stance, and he's convinced.
The hair
because
and fingerprints
he knows,
changes.
But when you have hair and fingerprints, it changes to, well, she could have been there. But then, you know, at what point does it also turn to who is manipulative enough to be able to plant this evidence? But I don't think that's the initial reaction. I think everyone kind of goes knee-jerk in, well, look, it's here.
Never found a body.
Never found a body. We got hair. And it doesn't change Jack's opinion.
No.
It's just everybody else is still in flux as to whether or not they believe Jack. And this further makes it difficult.
And then Jack gets hazy again.
He goes
off into the land of make-believe, where he plays, you know, your point about Jack will do anything if the ends justify the means, and doing anything includes jeopardizing a student's entire career by saying it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that. You should just, you know, that's not what I'm saying. And he's also a major dick to her at the beginning of that scene.
Oh,
so not only is he a dick, intentionally so, but then he asks her to go do the thing she wants to do that's unethical and illegal. But it's not my fault. I didn't ask you to do it. And I'm going to say that if you get caught.
Yeah.
I mean, what the
you
fuck?
You really should. After he gives her, you know, shit about, you know, you need to be in school. And,
yeah.
And then basically what
you
he's telling her.
You should be paying attention in class instead of doing this stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, so what message are you sending?
And at the end,
Jack?
He's like, well, maybe you don't need to go to class. You need to do this. Yeah. It is. It just swings back and forth. You know, is he just saying that to cover his ass? Like, oh, I read her the Riot Act, so if she did anything else.
Because really, that's the reason you do that.
I have it on record.
Unless he's being cute and like, okay, figure this out, Miriam. Figure this out. I'm going to throw this at you. Figure this out. Which brings us to my favorite scene in the episode.
Was it the
dinner between Hannibal, Alana, and Chilton.
Yes.
What an interesting combo of people for dinner here. And it gives us Chilton, again, just spewing lines directly from the books.
Oh, yeah.
Where he talks about how Dr. Gideon is a pure sociopath and so rare to find one in the wild.
In the wild, yes.
But one thing that was really cool is Ophelia and I were just watching the special features on the Blu-ray. And they were showing how the food designer designed.
Oh,
because it's so difficult. Because so first a chef designs the concept of the meal.
Right.
And so then a designer designs the look of the meal. But then she also has to take into account that these actors are going to be eating this a lot.
Yes.
So it can't be too spicy. It usually can't be what it is
what
supposed
it's supposed
to be.
Right. It's just bland.
And so this episode
has
the tongue.
It also has the last unrefrigerated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And so she talked about how she created tongue out of, it was like a bread or tofu-ish.
Oh, interesting.
And it was molded into these shapes and then you treat it the way you would treat. So all the food is possible.
Yes.
It's just not actually what it is.
What it is.
And it brought it up right away when I saw the tongue being delivered.
Yes.
And it's like, oh yeah, we watched that thing, which is cool. So I highly recommend, if you have the Blu-rays, watch the special features about this. Miko, you're not allowed to watch them until the end of the season.
Yes, it's
because again, well, I mean, no, these special features you can watch when we finish season one.
All right.
Okay.
Right.
There's a lot of things we can't show you until we finish season two, but season one we'll have a special features.
That would be nice
because it is very interesting to hear the chef talk about the psychology about what he's choosing for the dinner
and being so giddy.
And, goodness, he is obviously a fan or fanable. To hear him just get so excited about, oh yes, I would. It's just meat. I mean, eating people. I mean, really, it's not a big strange concept in chefs. And I'm like, oh boy, I think you might be crossing a controversial line here. But he seems very fanatic about wanting to implement the how would you prepare the
and,
right.
And he's fully on board with the you can eat every piece of the body.
Right.
Yes.
Here's how you would.
Here's how you would eat every part of a human body
and, so
and consume it so where there's no more evidence.
Again, we have a metaphorical dinner, tongue, that came from an especially chatty lamb, which is now silent because it has no tongue and is dead.
Yes.
But
silence of the lamb.
The lamb.
And
yes.
Dr. Chilton's tongue is feisty.
Yes.
Particularly feisty.
Feisty.
What did he say? You better watch out. Your tongue
is your tongue is particularly feisty. And then right away, this is the silence of the lamb's trifecta here.
Yes.
Where he says, this dinner shows us it is nice to have an old friend for dinner.
Yes.
Which is the last we know of Dr. Chilton in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
So really, I mean, that was the lovely on-the-nose Brian Fuller winking at the audience mm-hmm. stuff. And it felt, I mean, there are really that scene and a later scene with Jack and Hannibal really felt like Brian Fuller's writing. Mm. That felt in tone with the rest of the series. Mm. That felt consistent so far. And then we take Chilton into the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah.
Hannibal basically leans on him. Yes. It's like, okay, you know, by the way, I wouldn't have any problem with somebody using psychic driving to find out information. Right. I wouldn't be so judgmental.
Yes.
You can tell me, exactly. Dr. Chilton.
He's basically, you know,
in me. Yeah.
Suggesting
me
him do something
secrets.
Unethical and basically saying, I won't have a problem with it if you decide.
Which is
to do
an interesting
that.
Mirror to Jack Crawford doing almost the same thing earlier.
Right.
Just
willing
in the other
to
side, yeah.
Have mm-hmm. one victim to save mm-hmm. others.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's cool because it sets up a reoccurring thing on this series where Chilton is like poor man's Hannibal Lecter. Chilton is the guy who wants to be what Hannibal Lecter is. Hannibal Lecter is incredibly well-respected. Mm-hmm. Hannibal Lecter is a man of art, a man right. of means, a man of food. Mm-hmm. And Chilton, you watch him at this dinner, and it's almost like he's looking to Hannibal for cues.
Yes.
And then he can add those affectations to his personality,
right.
you know. Chilton is a man built of, he's a man of nothing. He is
right.
nothing.
He
assembles his personality. Yeah.
Yeah, acquired things from other people.
And whereas Hannibal is doing it because he actually is blank.
Right.
Chilton is doing it because he's desperate.
But, yeah.
And I think that's why I like Chilton, because he's a fascinating character. He's not a good guy in any
no,
way,
no,
but
no.
he's a really interesting character, and he only becomes more interesting as we move
well,
on.
Well, you know, usually the good guys aren't the ones that are exciting. It's always the different ways
guys.
People can be bad.
Yeah.
So then,
and we get a third.
We get a third
another call.
Call
that now we can trace.
Right.
Yes.
And the call is coming from inside the beautiful
yes.
Toronto Observatory.
Observatory, yes.
With the blue door.
Yes.
Which simultaneously made me think of TARDIS and made me realize just mm-hmm. how much blue we have in this episode.
Oh, there's always a lot of blue, and there's more.
But I think it's
in
overdone
this
in this episode. Mm-hmm. Really, everything is in blue, from the dungeon to Will being in blue to the blue door. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have a question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why, except for stagey, hoary drama, would the FBI show up at a supermarket with the full SWAT team and Jack with a shotgun, show up at a family's house to stop a child with a full SWAT team and Jack with a shotgun, but show up at the observatory
with nothing
to find an FBI agent who has gone missing, who's directly linked to the Chesapeake Ripper, who we thought was behind bars, but isn't? The Chesapeake Ripper mm-hmm. may be at this observatory.
Right.
Jack and Will walk in.
Katz is there.
Is a Beverly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No guns, even
no, no.
out.
No guns drawn.
Nope.
And the FBI is waiting outside
yeah.
for them. Why? Other yeah. than, because the show wants to give us the reveal of that arm.
Yes.
Rather than an FBI agent saying, no, Jack, she's not in there, but her arm is.
Right.
I get it. Yeah.
Or
it's
they come out, like, you know, ashy-faced and so, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, did you find her? Yeah, that those yeah, conventions, yeah. Well, sort of.
But it's,
and then they go in and they find, yeah, you know, there. It does seem like it's going for some obvious,
yeah.
you know, rather than doing that or having the SWAT guys come in and then come out and not be able, they just go right in.
Yeah.
You know, they want to go, he wants to, like, go straight for the reveal, you know, rather than having it make sense.
And it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's
and
true.
And they don't
it's
usually
like,
cheat. You know, yeah. and I think, you know, the show figures it out.
Mm-hmm.
But with the cheat at the end of the last episode, and then this episode full of holes and cheats, it's they're floundering a bit in the beginning.
It's not a good time to flounder.
It's not.
No. Yeah, because I can see if maybe they were playing it and that they may have become more more convinced that she was dead.
Mm-hmm.
So then they were no longer. But that doesn't seem to make sense. I would think that somebody would want to go in with the idea that perhaps she might still be alive,
tied up.
Right. So then it would make sense. Maybe they didn't come out with the whole complement of SWAT teams, but there should be somebody who goes in with mm-hmm. weapons drawn and to kind of,
yeah.
you know, let's clear the room, place before the Jack and Will come in. I don't know. You're right. It does seem like not, this is not procedural.
Yeah.
Why
is this not a threat?
Right. Why is there not the possibility that a killer could be in that room when they get there?
Yeah.
And that this could be a trap.
Not only a possibility, it's likely.
It's likely. It's a trap. I wrote down...
Thanks, Admiral Ackbar.
I wrote down here, what do you see?
Well, there was a note.
That was on the note.
On Miriam's arm.
That's what it is.
Blood splatter.
And Will, I mean, we, the audience, connect that back to Garrett Jacob Hobbs saying
see.
But the show knows that we haven't heard about Garrett Jacob Hobbs in 2 episodes.
Yes.
Now. So we have to remind you mm-hmm. that he said that, so we have a quick flashback of him saying that.
Yes.
And that's interesting. What do you see?
Mm-hmm.
Because what is it asking? You know, and this is something that I'm not sure of, and I don't know that it ever really deals with it. So what is it asking? Is it the Chesapeake Ripper asking, what do you see? Is it just the, okay, if her arm is here and she's calling and she's not alive, that means I'm out there and you're doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is this about?
Yeah, it is kind of vague.
Yeah. So, there's that.
Mm. I'm not sure.
But then we move to a nicer scene, a better scene.
A warm scene.
A warm scene.
Hannibal and Jack.
Yep, and Jack in brown.
Although somehow still, slightly creepy.
Well, it's creepy because he's very close to Hannibal in the dark in front of a fire.
Yeah.
You know, Hannibal at any moment could just go, face in the fire.
Face in the fire.
Yeah. And make that sound. And then really, it's completed. Done. You know, they are not allowed to use that sound.
Oh, because it's owned by the movie. Yeah. Wow.
MGM is very protective of that specifically.
So interesting that you cannot use someone making that noise.
It's irritating, really.
But I found it interesting in this little back and forth conversation that they have while they're drinking by the fire that Hannibal actually apologizes for what is happening to Jack's wife, and Hannibal actually apologizes to Jack for Miriam Lass.
Mm-hmm. Which we in the episode, we have not yet seen that Hannibal is the one who got Miriam.
Not yet.
We're about to. But it's interesting because I truly believe Hannibal cares about Jack to the point where if Jack was after him, he'd probably stop.
Right.
But cares about him at the moment. Truly likes Bella.
Yes.
And is upset that she is dying because he does say the world is a better place with her in it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, feels bad that Bella's dying, and I'm sorry I killed your student. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. It's going to sound like I'm sorry that you're going through this, but I'm actually sorry I did this thing. And I'm sorry what you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's talk about Miriam, the last flashback, and which is the finding of the Wound Man picture.
Yes.
Yep.
In Hannibal's office.
The most creepy I have felt so far in this whole season. Possibly up until the end of season 2. Is the scene where he is going to retrieve his old medical records from Miriam Lass. And he climbs up those...
The ladder. Nice little ladder
to the balcony. Yeah.
And then as she's nosing around like you do as a
FBI
trainee and uncovers the sketch, we see him crawling like a creepy little spider with his shoes off, barefoot, down the ladder, and then with what felt like like a sped up film.
Silent, too.
Yeah, because he's taking his shoes off.
Sped up, right behind her, and then we see her choking out. Now, I'd also like to point out that you can be choked out without being killed.
I'll play the Jack Crawford moment.
Sure.
She is dead. She's dead. I refuse to acknowledge the fact that she might be alive. She may be phone calling me, but I refuse to acknowledge the fact.
You can cut off an arm and you can cauterize it before death.
That's very true.
It's been done for years, all the way back to before we had modern medicine. So you are skeptical
that Miriam Lass is dead.
I'm not skeptical, but I'm not 100%.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Well, this is a momentous moment for the series.
Mm-hmm.
This is the moment where it is 100% confirmed that Hannibal Lecter is a monster.
Yes.
Because
this is the
Hannibal.
Point.
This is where Hannibal becomes the Chesapeake Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have known about the Chesapeake Ripper for an entire episode. We've heard nothing but the horrendous things that the Chesapeake Ripper does.
And this is the first time he's ever laid hands on anybody in violence.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is it. Yeah.
We actually get to see it.
Hannibal the Monster shows up in this episode, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Because now there's not... And that's really... this kickstarts the back half of the season. We're halfway now.
Okay, cool.
And so with that, I wanted to ask Miko...
Yes?
You've seen half a season of this show.
Yes.
How does that feel first, the first half?
Oh, enjoying every bit of it. Like I said, it's just, it's everything you want that you don't get from network TV.
Yeah.
You know, and it's refreshing to see them doing something so original, even though they're taking so many different pieces from other shows. We've talked about it as kind of plagiarism, but I never feel like it lets me down.
This episode I feel was plagiarism. The other episodes I feel are homage.
It's because they did too much of it, and it was too much direct. You know,
burned this episode.
They kind of did it too much. Whereas before,
or it's just a well-done steak. How about that?
Okay.
Usually we're rare to medium rare. This is gray.
The steak is gray. It's a little overdone.
Yeah.
Whereas in previous episodes, what they were doing is they were taking elements. It's like taking ingredients and mixing it together and creating a new dish.
A pastiche.
Yes.
Perhaps. Exactly. Taking little bits and pieces of things from here that weren't like directly correlating to other people. Taking, like we were saying before, taking scene descriptions, taking dialogue and giving them to other people. It seemed more like we were creating it, you know, something new here, whereas this was straight out. They talk about the bow accident in the thigh, and that's also, it was like
direct,
after a while direct, it was like that's also in. It seemed like there was a lot more, and they kind of overdid it. They added too much of the ingredients and they muddled it in the in the process.
TMI, okay, so I have questions for you. What do you think the back half of the season is going to entail?
I have no idea at this point.
Okay, good.
Only because every time I think I know what's going on, things shift.
Well, and that's one of the things this show does really well.
Mm.
It consistently surprises me. Yeah. And I didn't expect that a show that's a prequel would consistently surprise me. What has been the most intriguing favorite elements of the first half of the season that you hope we get more of?
Now that we're seeing more facets of Hannibal, he's not hiding as much anymore. I would like to see more of that. Because now we're revealing...
The machinations.
Yes.
Well, it's no longer hiding. The show isn't hiding it anymore either. Yeah.
Yeah, before it was a little snippet, a little something. And then in these two episodes specifically, we're coming right out and basically saying it. And he's showing more emotion and things like that. I would like to see him, have us see him more revealed as the monster, you know, over the course of the episode. I'd like to see a return to just using the books as... sort of, you know...
Seasoning,
yeah. And not overdoing it like they did to this. And surprising me more. Don't go, oh, that is like that person. And, you know, really mix it up so that I get an honest-to-God surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's what's going to keep you know, especially all of us that have experience with the movies and the books and everything else, is going to keep us going, is having some wonderful surprise. So I like not only to have Hannibal be more revealed, but it would be great to have something come out at the end that I was thoroughly not expecting.
Mm.
Yeah. It's interesting because we've now, we haven't seen Abigail.
In a couple episodes.
In a couple episodes. So I'm sure we will revisit that at some point and see where that's going. I'm not too invested in the Jack Bella storyline right now. I don't know why I'm not. I would love that to be a thing and go away very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I can see them drawing it out because it's a great way to manipulate your audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be happy if it becomes less of a focus, and as we get back into Hannibal's storyline, there's hardly any Hannibal Will.
It's very little.
Mm-hmm. It's all Hannibal Jack.
Well, we were spending a whole lot of time with fake Hannibal.
Yes, yes. Which I would love to see more, you know, of him.
Well, Eddie Izzard does come back.
Great.
I'll tell you that.
Because it's also fun to have the two psychopaths play off each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it is a war of egos. So I definitely would. And they're two great actors playing sort of their own wonderful psychopaths. So I would love to see more of that. Other than that, I don't know. Like I said, I really enjoy being taken on the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea. I sit there and I wonder, what are they going to do with this? How are they going to deal? When is this thing going to be real? But I really don't want to predict when, because I really want to be surprised.
Okay.
It could be, there are things that I'd like to see. It could be at the end of the season. It could be next season. No expectations.
No expectations. Okay,
no expectations.
Good. Well, you can send us a message if you have any thoughts. If you want to tell us that this was your favorite episode and we're all just wrong. You can do that by emailing us at eattherootcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at eattherootcast. And please subscribe to our iTunes feed and come on over to iTunes and leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it.
Yes.
Again, we are looking for a logo for the podcast, so if you have anything, please send it over. We'd love to see what you got. And we'll see you next week for the sorbet course.
Ah.
Of this season.
Oh, we have a palate cleanser.
We do. So, you can picture in your mind what that might mean for an episode of Hannibal. Because this was the entree. It was a meaty episode. Not a very good one.
Well, you know, it's an introduction.
Mm-hmm.
An entree is leading you into the meal. So, maybe it's like, you know, one of those, like, the middle movie in a trilogy where it shoves so much.
It's the Back to the Future
bridging.
Too.
Yes, exactly.
There
exactly.
We go. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us at the table.